Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we discuss a huge issue for Albuquerque, reforming its police department. As you will no doubt recall, between 2010 and 2014, the APD shot and killed nearly 30 of our citizens. This prompted an investigation by the Department of Justice. Then, on March 16, 2014, police video captured their killing of James Boyd, a mentally ill homeless man camped out in the Sandia foothills. Shortly thereafter, the DOJ released a scathing report on the APD's unjustified use of force, and about 6 months later, Albuquerque and the DOJ entered into a consent decree which was intended to reform the APD. Here to discuss all this is Pete Dinelli. Pete previously served as Deputy DA, Chief Public Safety Officer, and as a city councilor. Pete Dinelli, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Pete, you've become a critic of the reform process, and we'll spend most of the show on that. But would you agree with me that the killing of James Boyd, followed so closely by the release of that scathing report, was really a game changer for Albuquerque?
It was clearly the shooting of James Boyd was a game changer. And one of the things that I'd like to clarify is that I don't consider myself a critic of APD. What I consider myself is an advocate of police reform. And I've done that throughout my entire career, especially starting when I was a city councilor. But the shooting of James Boyd, which occurred, I believe, was in March 16th, 2014, that clearly was a major game changer. The fact is, though, is that the Department of Justice had already come to Albuquerque and was doing an investigation.
Yeah, it had been going on maybe 2 years before that.
Roughly a year and a half. And what happened was is that in 2010, when the new mayor took over at the time, there was a major change in management. And that was the year that you had a number of police officer-involved shootings started. And what happened was that the Department of Justice came in about a year later, which would be in 2011, and they really started to aggressively investigate the Department of Albuquerque Police Department. The James Boyd case, when it occurred, the shooting actually occurred, it turns out the DOJ was on the verge of releasing its report. And in fact, the Boyd shooting was nothing more than a small footnote within the DOJ report that came out the following month, which was in May. That is in April or May after the Boyd shooting. And in that footnote, it said is that the Boyd shooting was just a continuing example of the Albuquerque Police Department's culture of aggression, which they had found. And they felt that also the remarks of the chief at the time was a reflection that this was an ongoing situation.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting about the Boyd shooting is that it does seem to be reflective of prior shootings by the APD. That is, you had this incredible showing of force at with James Boyd. I think there was 10 or 12 heavily armed police officers.
About upwards to 20.
Oh,
and,
all right, 20.
In fact, you had the SWAT unit that was called out.
And you had this homeless, mentally ill camper who had these two knives that he sometimes brandished and sometimes didn't. The canine unit was used. They used a flashbang grenade, and then when he was seemingly turning to give up, they shot him. And this seems like so. And then, as you said, Chief Eden said it was justified. The police immediately all said they felt they were in danger, and that's why they shot. Because it was captured on video, for the first time, the public and everybody else could see that this was really not so. And it sort of put the lie to the prior arguments that the police had been making about their shootings.
Well, the representation made is pretty accurate as to what happened during the last few minutes of the man's life. Keep in mind that they had been out there for a number of hours. In fact, it was 10 or 12 hours, I believe, where they had called in the crisis intervention team. And it turns out that Mr. Boyd had had previous encounters with the crisis intervention team, as well as the Albuquerque Police Department. They knew this man was unstable. They knew he was mentally ill. Yet they used the amount of force that they did rather than pulling back what they felt is that they needed to go ahead and escalate it. And what resulted was is that the very next day after the shooting, you had a chief of police that gets up in front of all the entire newsmen and pronounces it, as you said, as justified. It turns out it was not justified. In fact, what this led to was another investigation that is with the district attorney's office as well as an internal affairs investigation, and it was found that it was not justified.
Yeah, and I think there were so many prior shootings that the internal affairs unit and the chief had found to be justified, and we can't possibly talk about all of them, but I did want to mention, like, for example, one of the early ones was Ken Ellis.
That's correct.
And he was an Iraqi war veteran with PTSD. He was apparently the police thought he was driving a stolen car. They cornered him in a 7-Eleven lot, and he was pointing a gun at his head, threatening to kill himself. Mm-hmm. And then he was shot.
Again, that is another example of what happened with the dealings of the Albuquerque Police Department in dealing with the mentally ill and their failed crisis intervention team's training in trying to resolve the situation. That is the Department of Justice report, which came out in 2014, I believe it was. Again, it examined 18 officer-involved shootings. But what has happened in the last 6 years is that there have been over 40 now police officer-involved shootings that have resulted in the payment of over $40 million in settlements. The Ellis case is one. The Boyd case was actually settled.
Yeah, I think Ellis got a jury verdict for over $10 million, they settled it for about $8 million.
Yes, that is correct. But the other thing is that also the Boyd case was settled for $6 million.
Right.
Again, here was a case that was called justified by the chief, yet they settled it civilly. And what has now happened is that the two main police officers who actually fired the fatal shots have now been charged through a preliminary hearing by a court of law.
Seems like training. Like I'm a tennis player. I constantly train to mm-hmm. play better mm-hmm. tennis. But when I get out there, a lot of times I don't play better tennis.
Well, what you brought up was the core issue. It was the training that these individuals had received over the years, and also the dealing with crisis intervention.
Yeah.
And the systematic approach that APD had, where you also had a finding by the Department of Justice of a culture of aggression within the department. And it took years for it to build up. But the reality of it is, when you say years, probably over a period of 5 or 6 years, and where it really came to a head. And once again, the two shootings that you identified were very similar when you're dealing with mentally ill, but there were two other major cases, which I think you had mentioned previously. But the history of this is that Albuquerque Police Department has had a real serious problem whenever it dealt with the mentally ill. And this goes back to
those two cases, the Alan Gomez and Chris Torres case, both, again, two mentally ill individuals that were shot and killed. Both of them resulted in large settlements and large verdicts.
That's correct. But you also have a situation where the Albuquerque Police Department has had some serious tragedies inflicted upon it because of dealings with the mentally ill. But in 2005, there was a major event that occurred that had an effect on the Albuquerque Police Department as well as law enforcement in general. And that is where you had a mentally ill individual by the name of John Hyde who killed two police officers. Also in addition to three citizens.
Yes.
And I think that event then was followed up by the shooting of James McGrain 6 months later. He was a sheriff's officer. And I believe that in that year is when you saw a major shift, a definite change in the Albuquerque Police Department in its training and its attitude towards the public.
Well, I want to talk to you next about the consent decree, but
sure.
I want to take a quick break first. We are back on New Mexico, People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm here with Pete Dinelli. Pete, among other things, was the chief deputy DA for a fairly significant period of time. And, Pete, I want to talk to you now about the consent decree.
Sure.
The consent decree covers all kinds of stuff. Not just the use of lethal force, but the use of all kinds of force and all sorts of other things. And I wonder if you could just generally describe the consent decree that the city of Albuquerque ended up entering into with the Department of Justice.
Well, what happened was that the Department of Justice, after a year and a half, issued, as you said, the scathing report regarding the Albuquerque Police Department, where there was a specific finding of a culture of aggression by the Albuquerque Police Department. And they came up with this consent decree. And in the consent decree, they specifically agreed to make major changes in policy. There were 30 major policies, including the use of force policy, that had to be rewritten or renegotiated and redrafted by the Albuquerque Police Department. But in addition to that, they agreed to make major changes to 277 major policies that were also included in the consent decree. And that's where we're at today. They also agreed to make major reforms when it came to dealing with behavioral health issues, that is crisis intervention, as well as training, and also in hiring, and also the type of training that was provided to those that were hired, and also implement a better screening process.
There's so much. Actually, that's one of my criticisms of it. There's training, there's supervision, there's crisis intervention, there's civilian oversight, there's the reporting system, there's the canine unit, the bomb squad. I mean, and I guess to be honest with you, it's over 100 pages long.
Actually, I think it's close to 200.
It seems
pages.
To me, if you're going to reform or change a culture with a legal document, it needs to be simple and concise, and this thing is, you know, maybe justifiably, because there were a lot of problems with the APD. Well, there's so much in it that you kind of don't know where to start.
Well, keep in mind, they agreed to 277 reforms,
right,
which were outlined in the settlement, 277.
Right.
And one of the last reports of the Federal Monitor said that they only had implemented 8.
Yeah, that's the latest
report. Right.
And let me ask you specifically about this monitor issue. You know, normally in a lawsuit, it's the plaintiff, the winning
Correct.
Party that you know, pursues violations or tries to get the other party to act pursuant to the decree that was issued by the judge. Here, it seems like the DOJ has kind of backed away from it. We have a monitor, and the monitor's strength is in he has the power of the pen. He writes reports, and then he, you know, says things. But I mean, it seems to me like it's not proceeding like certainly citizens like me would have wished. It's not proceeding with great rapidity, and there's not getting great results. It doesn't seem like.
Well, keep in mind that was part of the negotiations. The Department of Justice entered into negotiations with the city, and the city did not want and under any circumstance agree to a takeover of the Albuquerque Police
Right.
Department.
Right. No city would want that.
So what they did agree to do is that we will agree to a federal monitor who will be appointed by the court with basically the parties agreeing to who it was going to be. And it's very specific. The federal monitor, by the way, supposedly is to be here for 4 years. He's being paid $4 million. But when you read the consent decree, there's the rub. The consent decree is very specific. The federal monitor has no authority, no management authority
right.
over APD, any of its command staff, or any city official. All the federal monitor can do is review and audit, and it's very specific.
Right. So,
in other words, the monitor has no authority.
So where are we going with this? I mean, he complains that he says something like he's not at all pleased with the progress. And he specifically points to the city attorney, Jessica Hernandez and saying that she's just delaying things. He meets with the city council and says, you know, you got to do more, even though he refused to meet with them earlier. I mean, it seems, and the whole process just seems dysfunctional. If what you're talking about is actually reforming the police, it's taking them so long, it's taking the APD so long to draft the policies, and there's so few that have been drafted, and the monitor is so critical. I mean, it seems like we're not getting
very. Well, again, the monitor was very specific. He accused the city of delay, do little, and deflect tactics.
Yeah.
The problem is, though, is that the monitor has no authority, and he cannot draft these changes. And part of the problem is that some of the individuals that either created, contributed, or do not stop this culture of aggression are still in charge. And I'll be very specific. One of the units that the DOJ was very critical of and came down hard on when they did their investigation was the SWAT team.
Yeah, very critical.
And the SWAT team commander retired and came back, and now he's the assistant chief of police. And this is I've had a real problem from day one. And my argument is that too many of the individuals that either helped create or did not stop or was involved with this culture of aggression are still there and now are in policy positions. And that, I think, is part of the problem.
You need buy-in from the command staff and from the political administration to make the changes.
I'm not confident. I agree with you. I'm not confident that there is complete buy-in. I don't think the fact that this monitor said what he did, but on the other side of the coin.
But is that typical of? I mean, these others. I think there's some 20 cities that
there's 18 cities that are involved,
and cities are always kind of reluctant to be forced into one thing or another.
And that's been part of the problem with a lot of these other consent decrees and other agreements. They've taken anywhere between 8 to 16 years to implement. And what bothers me is that you had a monitor that said, I'm confident that we're going to be able to get this done in 4 years. And now he's already hedging his bets.
He's already said 8 years, right? He's
talking about another contract. And there's no motivation for him to get the job done, to be perfectly blunt about it. I mean, why should there be? If all he has to do is sit back and monitor, instead of giving the police department a hand, they basically let this go for a long period of time, and only recently did the Albuquerque Police Department recognize that they needed help, and then they turned around and hired a federal judge to help them rewrite the policies. Well, turns out this retired federal judge has no background in writing police policy, let alone policy that has to be taught to officers and to ensure that there's constitutional policing in Albuquerque. So I am not at all optimistic that we're going to get anywhere near accomplishing what we need to accomplish within the time frame that's involved. They're already so far behind the process that I can imagine the federal monitor at the next report, he's going to say, we haven't made that much progress.
Well, let me mention, if you've just tuned in, that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. I'm here with Pete Dinelli. Pete, among other things, has been a city councilor, and he also ran for mayor a couple times. And that's kind of a lead-in to where I want to go with this, because it seems like basically what you're suggesting is we have a political problem. That is, what are the politics? If I were Mayor Barry and I was under this consent decree, I would want to get the best reviews from the monitor, and I would want the monitor to be saying, gee, the administration's really behind us. But to tell you the truth, in my view, that doesn't seem to be – it seems to be more like let's brush it aside, let's have people forget about it, let's push it off. But that doesn't make, to me, political sense if what Mayor Barry wants to do, which is what people think, is run for governor.
Well, I think what's happening is that they're running the clock on the administration. We cannot wait for another mayor's race. I've told this to Albuquerque City Councilors. I've actually told this to the federal monitor. I believe the time has come for somebody to take APD over, and the court needs to go ahead and order a takeover.
But the DOJ doesn't seem at all inclined to do that.
They haven't said anything publicly is the problem. But
they haven't taken over other police forces.
They have not, and that's part of the problem. But I really believe that I wouldn't be surprised if this administration is trying to run the clock so that when he leaves office basically in 19 months, that he's going to leave the mess.
But if there were a whole bunch of unjustified shootings that had happened, you know, maybe the DOJ would be interested in pushing this in the court. But basically, use of force has gone down, has it not?
Use of force has gone down. However, violent crime has gone up dramatically in the last last year alone. We've had a 53% spike in murders in the Albuquerque area. All the violent crime has gone up dramatically.
Lots more robberies, too.
A lot of robberies. And that's because you have a police department that is still in a meltdown when it comes to the number of police officers on the force.
But getting back to the – so, I mean, if the mayor just wants to run the clock out, then you have to turn to the city council. But before I do I just want to ask you about your politics because
– Let me emphasize something.
Yeah.
Just because police officer-involved shootings are down – doesn't mean that crime is down. It means that there has been an effect of the DOJ and reforms coming into play where you have police officers that are far more reluctant now to use their gun than they were before.
I mean, because that makes a lot of sense. Why
they're
use
afraid
your gun?
Because I think there's concern also that they do not know whether or not – they don't want to be proactive, but they also don't want to be result in criminal charges being filed.
But my point is the DOJ isn't going to try to actively take over a police department if it doesn't have evidence that the basic use of force, which it complained about, isn't rising
but it's
going down. But the city council doesn't seem particularly interested in any of these things. I mean, the city council has its own politics, right? I mean, this is sort of Mayor
Barry's. You've hit the problem right square on the head, on the nail on the head. And again, I get very frustrated because I know more could be done if people had the political backbone to do it.
But some of them are probably thinking about running for mayor themselves. Why not let Mayor Barry, you know, stew in this problem? Why take it over by the city council and then be criticized yourself?
Because it's a department that's in crisis.
No, I understand. I'm just about the politics
of
it. And what about your politics? Okay,
what about my politics?
So, as I understand it, you know, you've run for mayor before. You haven't ruled out running for mayor again. When listeners hear what you have to say, should they be taking what you say with a grain of salt? Because Pete Dinelli is, of course, he's going to be a critic. He wants to run against us if he runs.
Again, I am nowhere near that as far as making up my mind. The reality of it is I have been in public life for 28 years. This is nothing new to me as far as advocating police reform and citizen oversight. When I was a city councilor over 28 years ago, I was the individual that called for the creation of a position that actually oversaw the police department and citizens' complaints. It was the Independent Review Council. I have a long history of public service where I've actually been involved with overseeing the police department. Even when I was at the DA's office, I prosecuted three police officers who were involved in a multi-jurisdictional ring. What I'm saying is that you can take whatever I say however you want to say it. The fact is, though, is we have a police department that is in crisis now. Something has to be done now. We can't wait until the next mayor's race.
But the chances of getting some sort of independent oversight, independent to whom? Someone's going to have – unless they run for office, someone's going to have to appoint them.
I think,
so the city council would have to appoint them or they'd be under the mayor.
Somebody. I understand that. I think the city council could enact – an ordinance that would create the position of a public police commissioner, give that individual authority, remove him only for cause, remove him or her only for cause, specific reasons why they could be removed, give that individual authority to appoint a new chief, assistant chiefs, deputy chiefs, and reorganize that department and get a handle and control over the reform process. The federal monitor could it very easily be appointed the individual to take over the department by the federal judge? It's a matter of having the political will and backbone to call for this major change. And until that happens, nothing's going to happen.
So I want to hit one more issue, which you and everybody in Albuquerque is aware that crime has gone up. And they may not be as aware that the size of the police force is very down. That's something you've alluded to earlier in the discussion.
Well, I'll be very specific. Six and a half years ago, the Albuquerque Police Department had 1,100 officers. 1,100. We're down to 840 now. But what nobody reports is that only 404 to 420 of those officers are actually taking calls for service. Last year, we had 69,000 priority one calls, emergency calls, not to mention about 500,000 lower priority calls. So what you have is an overworked department, police officers that are trying to keep up with the caseloads, and yet you have a city council that's not willing to make the commitment, the financial commitment, to provide enough money for better recruiting.
Well, I mean, the answer of the administration is, you know, the union negotiated away a higher wage rate, and why don't we just bring back some of these retired officers? 95%, 99% of retired officers have an unblemished career.
We could bring them back
and increase the size of the police force.
You need a new generation of police officer with better training. And you don't bring back individuals that probably caused some of the problem.
But, I mean, you can vet every officer who used to be retired. You'll know who and 90, 95% of them are probably going to have an entirely clean record. Why not bring back the people who are experienced, who know what they're doing, and who've shown themselves to be, trustworthy, good, solid officers?
Well, the fact is, when you're dealing with calls for service, having men and women that may be middle-aged is not the way to go. It's a young person's profession. There's no getting around that. And you have to deal with the calls for services that are involved. And taking calls for service is probably the most difficult part of the job. Very few police officers who we have retired will want to come back to actually take calls for service and get back in that vehicle and patrol our streets. And that's part of the problem. Right now, we already have close to 100 police officers that are returned to work officers. They were allowed to come back before they changed the law. Where are they at? Well, they're stuck in the school system. They're police aides to the schools. And again, when you retire after the 20, 25 years as a police officer, the reality is you don't want to go back and you don't want to patrol the streets. You don't want to get back in that car and be exposed to a population now that is suffering from a tremendous increase in violent crimes. There's a real issue involving experience. I understand that. But experienced officers do not want to be put behind the wheel of a vehicle patrolling the streets and taking calls for service.
I'm afraid to say we're out of time. I would like to thank my guest today, Pete Dinelli. Pete has previously served as Chief Deputy DA and Chief Public Safety Officer. I would also like to thank the producer of this program, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available on iTunes. Search for Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.